Lecture 12, A Multilingual World, Medieval Attitudes Toward Language Change and Variation.
Hello, and welcome back to England in the Middle Ages. In this lecture, Lecture 12, we're going to look at some medieval attitudes towards language change and regional variation. I'm going to be developing some of the remarks I made in my previous lectures about regional dialects, but also about some attitudes towards what we called the diachronic in linguistic study. You'll remember the two axes of the study of language that were developed by scholars of the 19th century, the diachronic, which are the historical, and the synchronic, which is the study of language at a given moment. We've been looking at both. And in this lecture, I'd like to bring the two together to give you a sense, in closing this first part of the lecture series, a sense of how writers of the Middle Ages viewed their language changing and their language's own variety. When we look at medieval attitudes towards language change and variation, however, we need to go back to some of the earlier historical moments that we surveyed in the course. And I'd like to begin by going back to some Old English or some Anglo-Saxon moments. Now, you'll recall that in the Anglo-Saxon period, there was a moment when English, the vernacular, became the medium of instruction, when students could be instructed both in English and in Latin. During the time of King Alfred, at the close of the 9th century, schools and scriptoria were developed where texts were read and written in Latin and English. Alfred imported scholars from elsewhere in England and also from Europe in order to help with this project of translation. He came up with what we might now call a canon of literary and intellectual texts to study. And he also suggested methods of schooling children in the classics, classics perhaps both in Latin and in English. You'll remember, too, that I had talked about how the West Saxon dialect of Old English became something of a standard. This is not because West Saxon was inherently better than any other dialect, but rather because it was the regional dialect of Alfred, of the court at Winchester, and the dialect into which Latin works were translated, but also the dialect into which earlier texts of Old English were rewritten. Cædmon's Hymn, you will recall, is a text that originates in the north of England in the Northumbrian dialect of Old English. Yet, when we see it as part of the translation of Bede's Ecclesiastical History into Old English, we read it in West Saxon. Later, in the Anglo-Saxon period, in the 10th century, Bishop Ethelwold established a school in which English and Latin were the languages of instruction. He made English a primary aspect for English schooling, the schooling of English boys, and his pupils learned their lessons in what he called utriusque linguae, in both languages. Ethelwold also tried to regularize the spelling and the vocabulary choice and the style of Old English prose. Now, why is this interesting? It's interesting, I think, because we see a moment when the idea of a standard for the vernacular develops, when there's a consciousness of historical change and an awareness of dialect variation. And the question is asked, how can we select from earlier forms and regional varieties, a kind of language or a form of language that can be developed as a standard? After the Norman conquest, as English becomes a multilingual experience, as England becomes, for all intents and purposes, trilingual, and as the language, as it were, brings in or absorbs or seeks to synthesize the words and forms from French and from Latin, as well as from the earlier Anglo-Saxon inheritance, after the conquest, attitudes towards language change and variation take on a new pitch. In the 13th century, English aristocrats were acutely conscious of their own linguistic ability. What you had was a situation where not simply were French speakers layered on like a veneer on an Anglo-Saxon body, but rather where there was intermingling. There was intermarriage. One of the interesting ways of charting relationships among the French and the English in those centuries after the Norman conquest is, in fact, to look at people's names. There was a historian of England and of the world, a great historian of the 12th and 13th centuries, whose name was, in Latin, Odoricus Vitalis. But his name actually in the vernacular would have been Odoric de Vitae. Now, Odoric is a beautiful Anglo-Saxon name. But that surname, de Vitae, Odoric, the son of the victualler, that is, somebody who provided food for an army, is a victualler, our word victuals. Odoric de Vitae, someone who is clearly, just by his name, the product of an English mother and a French father. Names like this predominate throughout this period of the 12th and 13th centuries. And in the mid-13th century, a man named Walter of Bibbesworth wrote a textbook in verse for English gentry desirous of bettering their French. Now, what does this teach us about attitudes towards language change and variation? Let's look at a little bit of this text, and I'm just going to read a couple of lines of it aloud. Walter of Bibbesworth says a few things about vocabulary. He has the following lines. Vous avez la lèvre et le lèvre. La livre et les livres. You have the lip, la lèvre, and the hare, or the rabbit, le lèvre. The pound, la livre, and the book, le livre. What is Walter teaching? Walter is teaching English readers how to speak French. And he is teaching them again the idea of something they've lost, grammatical gender. You will remember that Old English had grammatical gender. It was a fully inflected language. Nouns were masculine, feminine, and neuter. But as the Middle English period began, Old English gradually lost grammatical gender. Gender of nouns became natural. French still retained, and retains to this day, grammatical gender. In the 13th century, it is clear that English speakers had so lost the concept of grammatical gender that it must be taught to them anew. And so words that sound very, very similar are presented as differing only in their grammatical gender. And this, significantly, is something that Walter has to teach them once again. In his treatise, Walter goes out of his way to teach what he thinks of as the best French. Not the French of English schools, but the French of France. What he calls the King's French. Now, this idea of good French and bad French, of continental French and English French, is something which would emerge over the next couple of centuries in England. It wasn't simply a case of whether you spoke English or French. It was a case of which language you spoke and how that signaled your social or your educational or your class-based identity. Chaucer can make a marvelous joke of this later at the close of the 14th century in his description of the figure of the prioress in the Canterbury Tales. In the prologue, or the general prologue of the Canterbury Tales, Chaucer will talk about how his prioress spoke French according to the school, as he says, of Stratford Atteboa. For French of Paris was to her unknowa. She spoke French according to the school of Stratford Atteboa, because Parisian French was unfamiliar to her. This is a wonderful joke. It's like saying, well, what kind of French? I learned my French at some of the greatest French schools in the world. Of course, when those schools happen to be in England, it creates a different social attitude. In the 13th century, about a century and a half or so before Chaucer's writing, Walter of Bibbesworth's treatise explicitly reminds the reader about different kinds of French and about the difference between English and French, not simply as one of vocabulary, but one of a special set of grammatical categories. Now, what did the Middle Ages think of language? This is a large and difficult topic, but there are a few aphorisms that I'd like to recall. Medieval theologians would say things like, man is a grammatical animal. Aristotle is famous for saying something to the effect of, man is a political animal. Man is an animal that lives in a polis. Man is an animal that lives according to political or diplomatic rules. Man is a social being. What does it mean, though, to say, man is a grammatical animal? Medieval theologians and scholars believed that humans had a gift for language, but that, in effect, we have fallen linguistically. In medieval theology, and this is very important to medieval conceptions of language history and language change, in medieval theology, there were really two falls. There was the fall in Eden. And what happened in the fall was not just that Adam and Eve got knowledge of good and evil, but that Adam and Eve had lost the language of Eden. You will remember in Genesis that Adam can name the animals. How does he know what the animals' names are? There is a sense of a kind of Adamic or Edenic language, a unique moment in human history when word and object mixed, when they were exactly the same. Our words now seem arbitrary or conventional or bound to certain languages. But medieval theologians believed that before the fall, there was just simply one essential word for everything. And that was lost in the fall. That's something very important. We don't hear a lot about that when we think about the fall. But for medieval writers, this was central. The second fall was Babel. When human beings fell from a general human language to a diversity of languages. Saint Augustine, the great thinker, church father, writing in the 4th and 5th centuries AD, put it this way: the diversity of language alienates man from man. Now, this is not simply a statement about mutual intranslatability, about the fact that human beings from one language cannot understand human beings of another language. Rather, it's about alienation. And Augustine's word in Latin is alienat, alienate, but also estrange. Living in the world for the medieval theological mind is living in a world of transitory things, a world that is sublunary, under the domination of the moon, a world of ambiguities, a world constantly shifting. What Augustine called a regio dissimilitudinis, a land of unlikeliness, or more literally, a region of dissimilitudes. Language in this world is therefore always going to be fluid, flexible, mutable, and transitory. Chaucer recognizes this. In his great poem of amorous history, Troilus and Crusade, set during the period of the Trojan War, Chaucer will reflect on how language has changed over time. I'm going to read you a little passage from this poem in which Chaucer talks about the change in language. Yek noa ek, that in form of speech is changed within a thousand year, and wordes, though, that had in priest, no wonder nis, and strange, us thinketh him. And yet, they spak em so, and spared as well in love as men knew do, ek for to win in love in sundry ages, in sundry longus, sundry ben usages. You know well, he says, that within a thousand years the form of speech has changed, and words then that had, and Chaucer's word is price, price, value. Words back then that had value or meaning now seem to us, as he says, wonder nis and strange, wondrously foolish and odd, it seems to us. And yet, they spoke 'em so. And yet, people really talked like that. And they sped, they succeeded as well in love as men do now. And so, to be successful in love, Chaucer says, in different times and in different lands, well, the ways of speaking and acting are different. Now, in this passage, Chaucer might be thought of as something of a linguistic relativist, let's say. He recognizes that men and women can communicate successfully in any language that they choose. He recognizes that the older languages are just as good as the contemporary languages. And he also recognizes that contemporary languages, the language, as he says, in sondre landis, are also just as good as his own. Chaucer gives us a view of what we might call the diachronic and the synchronic, the differences of language over time and over space. But Chaucer is also acutely aware of regional variation. Now, we saw in my lecture on Chaucer's English and in the subsequent lecture on dialects how Chaucer uses the dialectical resources of his language to make a compelling, powerful, and at times humorous poetry. We saw in the Reeve's Tale how he can play on dialect humor for particular dramatic or comic effects. Chaucer, however, was acutely conscious not just of what dialects did for humor, but what dialects did to writings. I had mentioned in an earlier lecture that in the Middle English period, scribes tended to write in their own regional dialects, and a text from one dialect could very easily be written into another. Chaucer is aware of this. In fact, he's more than just aware of it. He may even be afraid of it. At the close of Troilus and Crisaid, the same poem from which I read that earlier quote, Chaucer says the following: "And for there is so great diversité in English, and in writing of our tongue, so pray ye God that none misreate they, ne they mismetre for default of tongue." He's addressing his book. The thee is the book. You, my book, Troilus and Crisaid. Because, he says, there is such great diversity in English and in the writing of our language, so I pray God that nobody miswrite you or mismeter you because of a default of tongue, of that language. What Chaucer recognizes is that if his poem, written in the London dialect, strongly based on the East Midland dialect, if his poem is written by a scribe from another region, that the scribe will rewrite it into his own dialect. If he does it, it won't rhyme and it won't scan. That's what he means by mismetering. That's what he's afraid of. He's not simply afraid that his language will sound funny. He's afraid that the poem won't work as poetry anymore. It's this consciousness of regional variety and the recognition that, in some sense, we all live in a mutable, transitory, and sublunary world that informs the writings of a contemporary of Chaucer. In the 1380s, a man named John of Trevisa prepared an English translation of a great historical work written in Latin called the Polychronicon. And in the course of his translation, John of Trevisa reflects on regional variation and on linguistic history. And he provides us with, it seems to me, something of an intellectual gloss on the kinds of jokes and patterns that we saw in the Reeve's Tale and in the Second Shepherd's Play. And I want to wrap up this lecture, and indeed to wrap up this first of the three parts of this course of lectures on the history of the English language, with some quotations from John of Trevisa, because I think they illustrate in a very palpable way the richness, the diversity, and the fragmentation of the English language towards the close of the Middle Ages. "Englishmen," he said, "had from their beginning three kinds of speech, the southern, the northern, and the middle speech in the middle of the land, because they came of the three people, three different kinds of people, from the German areas, from what he calls Germania. And nonetheless," he says, "by commixtion," that means mixing together, "and melling," joining, melding, first, he says, "with the Danes," remember, the Scandinavians, "and after," he says, "with the Normans." And then he says, "in many the contrary language is appared, For many people, the language of the country is apeirid. Now, that's a Middle English word which means diluted or corrupted in some way. So here, the central presupposition is you've got a language that's pure, that's good. And then contact with other speakers somehow corrupts or dilutes or changes that language. This is something which John of Trevisi is saying at the end of the 14th century that many people, indeed many people in the 20th century, would argue is a feature of languages in contact. And then he offers an example which I must read in his original Middle English because it's so onomatopoetically evocative. Some of the speakers, he says, some useth, some use, strange laughing, chittering, harrying, and garrying, gris-beating. I don't think I even need to translate. Indeed, I don't think I could translate those words, because that's what he's saying. That's what it sounds like. The Greeks called the barbarians barbarians because their language sounded like bar, 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 just to them, because they weren't speaking Greek. This is John of Trevisi's way of evoking what he thinks of as the barbaric quality of different dialects. And he goes on. He says, this diluting of the birth tongue, and that is his phrase, the birth tongue, is because of two things. Now, one is, he says, because children in school, against or contrary to the manner and the usage of children in other nations, are compelled to leave their own language and to construe their lessons and their things, their objects, in French. 1385 or so, John of Trevisi is writing, and he is lamenting the fact that children with a birth tongue of English have to go to school and learn French. And they have done so, he says, so that the Normans come first into England, since the Normans came first into England. It doesn't matter whether his history is right, it's his ideology that's bothersome. Also, he says, now this is the second reason, gentlemen children, now we've got a class problem, not just an education problem. Gentlemen children are taught to speak French, he says, from the time that they are rocked in her cradle. From the time that they're rocked in the cradle. And cannot speak and play with a child his brooch. And what this means is they're taught to speak French from the time they're rocked in a cradle and from the time a child is taught to play with a toy. And uplandish men. Uppity men, men who want to advance themselves socially, will likna himself to gentlemen. These men will liken themselves or try to become gentlemen, and fondeth with great business for to speak French. And with great busyness, they will try to speak French. This is about a century and a third after Walter of Bibbesworth, and you see now the same problems. Language, dialect, social class, education, power. And then he says, it seems a great wonder to me how English, that is the birth tongue of Englishmen, and our own language and tongue, is so diverse of sound in this island. Here are all of these regional variations, he says. And the language of Normandy, he says, coming from another land, is, to a large degree, he states, pretty much of the same sound that the French is spoken in England. In other words, the French of England is like the French of Normandy. But nonetheless, he says, there is as many diverse manner French in the realm of France as is diverse manner English in the realm of England. In other words, here in England, we really only speak one kind of French, and that French is descended from Norman French. But in France, there are as many kinds of French as there are kinds of English in England. And then he goes on. All the language of the Northumbrous, all the language of the people living north of the Humber River, and especially at York, and especially in the city of York. And again, I have to read some of his marvelously untranslatable onomatopoetics, is so sharp, slitting, and frotting, and unsharp. It's so sharp, so slitting, so fretting, so scraping together, and unsharp, so ill-shaped. I mean, unsharp, think about it, it's as if it's ill-formed. The language is now not just made up of words, the language is like a thing that grates against him. It's like a blob, it's like some hideous, miscegenated creature. It's so slitting and frotting and unsharp that we sovereign men. He's addressing his audience. He's binding rhetorically to the audience. We sovereign men, may that language unetha understanda, that we may scarcely understand that language. I believe it is because that abuth, it is because those live nearby. They abut, as it were. Where do they live, these northerners? They live nigh, to strange men. To strange men. And this is his word in Middle English, and aliens and aliens. That speketh strangelich. Go back to Augustine. The diversity of languages alienate man from man. Now, at the end of the 14th century, John of Trevisa imagines not just a world in which language or its diversity alienates man from man, but in which people actually live near aliens. Who is Trevisa thinking of? What imagined aliens live in the north of England, a landscape so far removed from the south that its speakers are incomprehensible to we sovereign men? And also, he says, the reason why people in the north speak incomprehensibly is because that the kings of England wanteth always fare from that country. And it's because the kings of England have always lived far from that country. The kings of England are in the south. The aliens are in the north. Go back to the second shepherd's play. Mac comes in with his mock southern tooth, with his southern tooth or southern language, as an emissary of the king. The king lives far away from the north. Now, I've gone through Trevisa's passage in great detail, because I think it's a phenomenal statement about diversity, about change, and about attitudes. And I think what he has to say resonates profoundly with many of our own attitudes towards the English language and many of the attitudes that we will see throughout this course. Let's use Trevisa, too, to wrap up and review this first third of the lecture series. We began by looking methodologically at the ways of studying the history of the English language. We began also with the prehistory of English, with Indo-European, with philology, with cognate words and sound changes. We saw how Old English emerged from the mix of Germanic dialects on the continent to the diversity of regional dialects in the British Isles. We saw how Old English was changing from an inflected to an uninflected language. And we saw how the Norman conquest not only textured the vocabulary, but also the shape, the rhythm, and the sound of spoken language. In these most recent lectures, we've seen how the English language broke up, as it were, anew into regional dialects, how we saw that living in a multilingual world gives English men and women a profound sense, not just of their palpable verbal experience, but of the alienating quality of being a grammatical animal. And now, in Trevisa, we see politics and power, region and control, education and birth, speaking to us back perhaps from six centuries to idioms and ideologies that we ourselves are still possessed by. In the next course of lectures, we will be looking at changes in pronunciation in the great vowel shift, in the increase in language, and in the spread of English, not just through the British Isles, but to America and colonies and beyond. And let's just keep Trevisa in mind as we ask ourselves, do we live with those who are strange and alien, or do we live with those who speak like us and really are ourselves refracted in the mirror of our tongues? Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at teach12.com or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.